Robert Wrigley is often called a nature poet. It's not surprising, considering the titles of his books, like Reign of Snakes and Lives of the Animals. But Wrigley says all poets are nature poets, even the ones who live in cities, because they soak in the sensuous world all around them. But Wrigley has an advantage. He told Anne Strangechamps that the natural world is right at his doorstep, just outside his home in Idaho.
I can walk out my back door and walk in the woods for many miles without coming across a paved road. I have moose, deer, bear, mountain lions, wild turkeys, all sorts of beasts, just who live in the same neighborhood as I. And before that, we lived in the canyon of the Clearwater River, which is sort of the source of my previous book, Reign of Snakes. We lived about a half a mile from a place called Rattlesnake Point, and it was a pretty accurately named place. Many rattlesnakes there.
The snakes show up in a lot of your poems. So do moose, bears, deer, birds, all the wildlife you must see almost daily. I wonder if you'd start by reading one poem.
Sure.
The Other World?
The Other World. So here is the old buck who all winter long had traveled with the does and yearlings, with the fawns just past their spots, and who had hung back, walking where the others had walked, eating what they had left, and who had struck now and then a pose against the wind, against a limb snap, or the way the light came slinking among the trees. Here is the mangled ear and the twisted, hindering leg. Here, already bearing him away among the drifts of snow and the nightly hard freezes, is a line of tiny ants, making its way from the cave of the right eye over the steep occipital ridge across the moonscape shed horn medallion and through the valley of the ear's cloven shadow to the ground, where among the staves of shed needles and the red earthy wine they carry him, bit by non-bit, into another world.
That's sort of beautiful and chilling at the same time. Or is that not the right feeling?
No, I appreciate that a lot. I mean, beautiful and chilling seems a perfectly appropriate response to that poem. One of the things I love about animals is what one reviewer called their perfect fit with the cosmos, which is to say they live absolutely in the moment. They don't spend a lot of their time as human beings do fretting about what will happen to them after they die. They don't worry much about the afterlife. They worry about the current life. And I admire that very much about them.
I was trying to figure out when I read that what it is that seems chilling about it. And I thought, I think it's because at the end, the poem sort of alludes to some kind of transformation taking place at death, some sort of resurrection, perhaps, because that's what we think of as the transformation that might possibly happen after death. But then in the end, when you say they carry him bit by non-bit into another world, sort of implies really all there is flesh.
And I think that's probably the case. Although if you accept my theology, and my theology, I guess, is more animal-centered, I trust my animal self in many ways more than I trust my human self, if that makes any sense. Therefore, I see myself and I see that dead deer as transcending the life he lived and entering into some larger part of nature.
What do you mean when you refer to your animal self?
Well, that is a great question, and there's a way in which I'm not inclined to think about that too much. What I mean is that part of me that is sort of freed from the intellectual burdens and from the emotional burdens that afflict human beings probably more often than we wish. I mean, this is an ironic thing probably coming from a poet whose stock in trade is dealing with emotions, is confronting these kinds of intellectual dilemmas. But my animal self is that self that feels great calm in the world, that doesn't worry about the future, that is entirely alive in the now.
And in many of your poems make the same movement that this one, The Other World, did. That is, there's this kind of coming home at the end to that animal self. And it's almost a resistance to the human self, to the movement to find, I don't know, larger meaning. I'm thinking in particular of one that's written about your daughter, Do You Love Me?
Mm-hmm.
Would you read that one?
Oh, I'd love to read that one. It's one of my favorites. Do you love me? She's 12, and she's asking the dog, who does, but who speaks in tongues, whose feints and gyrations are themselves parts of speech. They're on the back porch, and I don't really mean to be taking this in, but once I've heard, I can't stop listening. Again and again she asks, and the good dog sits and wiggles, leaps and licks. Imagine never asking. Imagine why. So sure you wouldn't dare or couldn't care less. I wonder if the dog's guileless brown eyes can lie, if the perfect canine lack of abstractions might not be a bit like the picture books she read as a child before her parents' lips shaped the daily miracle of speech and kisses, and the words were not lead and weighed only air and did not mean so meanly. Do you love me? She says and says, until the dog, sensing perhaps its own awful speechlessness, tries to bolt, but she holds it by the collar and will not let go, until, having come closer, I hear the rest of it. I hear it all. She's got the dog's furry jowls in her hands. She's speaking precisely into its laid-back, quivering ears. Say it, she hisses. Say it to me.
Oh, that's again so chilling at the end.
Really?
Don't you think so? There's a... She both longs to have him answer her, and there's a slight feeling of meanness that she just will not let go of him, and she's grasped him and is trying to sort of force him to come out of his animal self.
Sure, and that's that's the function of the verb she hisses in that final line. I mean, she's making that extraordinary, impossible demand of the dog, and the dog would like to oblige, but the dog doesn't speak that way. The dog has no particular comprehension of that sort of love, or at least of that kind of articulation.
So what is it that writing about animals, thinking about animals, does for you?
Oh, good question. I almost can't help it anymore. I have a writing ritual. I get up in the morning on days I'm hoping to get some writing done, and I take a walk. I walk out the back door of my house, I walk into the woods, and I collect images. I just watch for what it is I might see. And I suppose in the bottom line, at base, it is simply that I am allowed a way to think about myself and to think about what it means to be human by thinking of it in terms of animals.
That helps me understand why so many of your poems about animals are really also about death. That's part of our animal self, I guess. Our bodies die. There's one that sort of gets at some of this I wanted to ask you to read, The Afterlife of Moose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, be happy to. The Afterlife of Moose. As the moose is obsessed relentlessly and with little or no variation with food, safety, and procreation, I am myself obsessed of late with God. Though by God, even I am uncertain what or who I mean, the word or the word in the mouths of those who would use the word as a bludgeon, the fabulous order of all disorderly things, or the perfect chaos that lives in straight lines, all the succulent preliminary whines and kisses, or the thrust and plunge and plosive release. I've been watching this particular bull for a good while now, as he feeds on the rich new shoots and shrub by shrub moves slowly through the forest. He knows I'm here. He eyes me now and then. This morning, I am in his mind as God never is, and what I wish I knew is whether or not I envy him that constant absence, or whether doubt might not be the source of all love, all the shimmer of truth, the flavors of beauty. Only a fool would see the moose's life as easier or less than his own. As for the afterlife, I'll take his chances.
That's lovely.
Thank you very much.
What was going on in your life that poem grew out of?
You know, a lot of this, I think, and we're sort of getting into the real heart of the matter, a lot of this is for me a kind of active disinterest in traditional organized religion. The wild world is my church. There's a way in which I trust the church that I move about in when I'm in the woods a whole lot more than I trust any sort of churchly advice. And I grew up in the church. But I find more, I guess I would say, evidence of the grace of God in the natural world than I do in organized religion. And so I quibble with that in that poem. At the same time that I quibble, you know, I have to admit there's that passage where I wonder if doubt is not the source of it all. That is to say, if you were absolutely certain, this is part of what goes on in that poem where my daughter's grabbing the dog and demanding, "Do you love me?" There's this sense that if you knew everything absolutely, there would be no need for faith. And the fact of the matter is, while I may have difficulties with traditional organized religions, I love the idea of faith. And what I guess I have is a sort of a deep envy of animal faith. I don't know if this, I'm talking myself into a kind of corner here, but I there's a way that animals demonstrate to me this sort of faith of simply being alive in the moment. It's not that they're not frightened of death. It's not that they're eager to die. They will fight. They will run. But at the same time, they understand that it's all about staying alive. It's all about survival. It's always about moving on, going to sleep, waking up day by day. And I just have this feeling that if human beings spent more of their life not worrying about what is to come or what has been, but concerned themselves with the absolute now, with the moment, that our lives would be better in some ways.
Robert Wrigley, talking with Anne Strainchamps. His books of poetry include Rain of Snakes and Lives of the Animals.
Kissing a Horse. Of the two spoiled barn sour geldings we owned that year, it was red, skittish, and prone to explode even at 14 years, who'd let me hold to my face his own. The massive labyrinthine caverns of the nostrils, the broad plain up the head to the eyes. He'd let me stroke his coarse chin whiskers and take his soft, meaty underlip in my hands and press my man's carnivorous kiss to his grass-nipping upper half of one, just so that I could smell the long way his breath had come from the rain and the sun, the lungs and the heart, from a world that meant no harm.